All right, thank you very much. I'll begin to introduce our panel now. To wrap up our session today, we have a distinguished panel of leaders and experts in different areas of education here to talk about the theme of our forum. I'll introduce the panelists and then our moderator in alphabetical order, and then I'll let our moderator take it from there in the order he chooses. To begin with, we're pleased to have with us Carl T. Hayden. Mr. Hayden was elected Chancellor of the New York State Board of Regents on three separate occasions, serving in that capacity from 1995 to 2002. A trial lawyer for more than 35 years with the Ziff Law Firm of Elmira, Mr. Hayden graduated from Hamilton College in 1963, served 4 years as an officer in the U.S. Navy, and graduated from Cornell University Law School in 1970, where he was president of the Law Student Association. He's been active in many community and school activities in the Elmira area. Richard C. Iannuzzi was elected president of the New York State United Teachers in April 2005. He's at the end of the table here. Mr. Iannuzzi taught elementary school in the Central Islip Public Schools for 34 years, including fourth grade for the last 20 of those years. He was active in the teachers' union throughout his career, starting, his official biography notes, with the strike that his union went on in his very first year on the job in 1970. A graduate of CUNY's Brooklyn College, Mr. Iannuzzi earned a master's degree from Hofstra University and a labor studies certificate from Cornell University. Next on the panel, in the middle of the table there, is Timothy G. Kramer. He's the executive director of the New York State School Boards Association, a position to which he was appointed in August 1998 after 19 years at the Ohio School Boards Association, where he was deputy director. Tim has a master's degree in public administration from Ohio State University, where he specialized in human resource administration and organizational development. He also earned a bachelor's degree from Kent State, majoring in political science. Thomas Rogers is the executive director of the New York State Council of School Superintendents, the statewide professional association for chief school officers. Dr. Rogers received his doctoral and master's degrees in educational administration at Columbia University Teachers College. He holds a bachelor's degree in biochemistry and a minor in primate anatomy from the University of Buffalo. He's an adjunct professor at the Lally School of Administration, of Education at the College of St. Rose, a frequent lecturer and writer, and serves on numerous boards and committees. And here at the end of the table, we have Sol Stern, my colleague, a contributing editor to City Journal and a Manhattan Institute senior fellow. Sol writes passionately on education reform, and his writings on that topic have helped shape the terms of the current debate in New York City. A longtime journalist who also served as a senior staffer to the president of the New York City Council, Mr. Stern grew up in the city, graduating from Stuyvesant High School and the City College of New York. He received an MA in political science from the State University of Iowa and did further graduate work at the University of California at Berkeley. His wife teaches in a public junior high in New York City, and his two children attend public school. Last but not least, now we have our moderator, my friend David F. Schaefer, who is president of the Public Policy Institute, the research affiliate of the Business Council of New York State. He's also corporate secretary of the Business Council. And among his many activities there that have special relevance to today's discussion, David has been in the lead staff responsibility for the Business Council's education reform agenda. And on a loan services basis, he's led a management review of the New York State Education Department, and he served on the Governor's Commission on Education Reform, better known as the ZARB Commission. Before joining the Business Council, David worked for 6 years as head of the Albany Capital Bureau of the Associated Press. He holds degrees in political science from Duke University and from the Graduate School of Public Affairs at the State University of Albany. So with no further ado, thank you very much. David, I'll give it over to you.
Broken down former journalist, I don't know the alphabet. So I'm going to go out of order a little bit and start with my friend Tim Kramer, because he's the first person from whom I ever heard about the concept of value-added testing, which is now what the governor wants to do. As Paul says, it seems to be the thing the most promising methodology to use. I think it was about 6 years ago that Timothy first mentioned it to me, and I'm curious whether in the intervening years, we heard that Florida sort of half uses it. Is anybody whole using it, and how's it working?
Yes, there are several states that have built this into their statewide accountability system. But before I say that, I want to thank our hosts for having this. I really do believe that the dialogue that's taking place here is actually surprising me as to how much we agree. And we should have more of these sorts of opportunities. So thank you very much. We look at accountability as really the main purpose for a Board of Education. That's why we exist. And we definitely support what the governor has proposed here. And we're definitely excited about the value-added concept being included. Indeed, I probably was one of the people who first introduced the concept of value-added to New York. I had spent time in Ohio, and Ohio now has in place a statewide system whereby their accountability measures are based on value-added measurements. And people who I had worked with in the past turned me on to this, said you need to be, in their term, this is rural Ohio people, you need to be the bell cow in New York. And that meant I needed to be kind of the one who was going to lead the charge, and I did. I brought some people here to New York and did a variety of briefings among people. And so I have to say I'm very pleased to see that this concept has made its way as far as it had. Basically, what the value-added piece will do is going to measure individual student progress from year to year. It controls for certain factors both in and out of the classroom. And what I really like about it is it also sets forth a trajectory as to what it's going to take for that student to reach the learning standards and graduate from high school. Some kids might be on kind of a slide and glide path, where others might be a more steep path. And it sets forth that. Done over a several year period of time with some sort of longitudinal studies, we do see patterns of very strong performance. You can predict what the performance is going to be from year to year, and you can measure performance from year to year, both at the district level, the school level, the cohort level, the teacher level, and the student level. It's very good for measuring student progress. The experts that I know in this field tell me that they would issue some caution as to whether or not it's good for measuring individual teacher evaluation. So I'd be careful on that. But I would tell you that in Ohio and Pennsylvania, those two states that have this ongoing statewide right now, the teachers want this information. They use it for diagnostic purposes. They use it because they want to know how well am I doing with my kids? What can I do differently in the future? It's very good for measuring students from all kinds of backgrounds. I think it's exceptionally good for kids who come from a disadvantaged background because you can show progress toward the standard. These people might not get any progress. We talked about the AYP piece a moment ago. These schools might be identified as schools in need of improvement, never get any credit for the progress they're making with kids who come from a very serious educational deficiency. Whereas it also is good for measuring kids who you would expect would always be above the standard, your AP students, because what you can set forth there is how much are we going to set the growth goal for that student from year to year. So you're pushing all these kids on a trajectory upward, and I like that. We have here in this state a pilot project underway with the Capital Region BOCES. It was mentioned that New York City has a value-added system in place. That is true. We have 15 districts in year number two of our value-added pilot project. It's very inexpensive to process the value-added information. And it is the costs for it are very reasonable. And I really don't think that we need to reinvent the wheel. I don't have anything to sell, but I do think that there are processes in place already in other states that we could use here in New York.
No, that's interesting. Thank you. Dick Iannuzzi on my right is the only one up here who was actually teaching. So the second grade, I think, right, when all this stuff started. First, when New York changed its testing system, and then as NCLB rolled out, and I'd just be interested in hearing your perspective on not just your personal experience, but obviously your members' experience, and what the impact of all this has been on teachers and where you think this is taking them.
Well, let me start by also thanking everyone here for a dialogue. I think The governor has put out a budget that makes a very real commitment, and that means that we all have to be prepared to sit at the same table and ask the very hard questions, and that is clearly why I am in this room today. Correct you and say that I taught fourth grade. Now, that's critical because the commissioner and I know that whenever I'm sitting with the commissioner, I always get to say to him, remember, I gave every sampler you ever sent back to an elementary school. I gave every test you ever sent to an elementary school. So, you know, I think that accountability is actually something that teachers welcome, despite the fact that we're often criticized about, you know, where we are in accountability. We live and breathe accountability in the classroom. The first day of school, you walk into that classroom, and if you are not accountable with respect to classroom management skills and content awareness, those students will let you know it very, very early in the very first day. So you are accountable in that way. You're accountable to your administration who comes into your classroom and observes you. You have a annual professional performance review for every school district in the state that has to be followed, that evaluates teachers on a regular basis. You have teacher improvement plans to stay with. You have parents who react to what you do send home and what the children claim you are saying in the classroom, so that you have to be accountable to those statements on a fairly regular basis. You have to be accountable to the press that prints just about everything that might just get a rise out of the local community. You have to be accountable to your peers, because if you're teaching in fourth grade and you're giving the test and everybody knows those scores are in the newspaper, so your peers put as much pressure on you as anyone else to be sure your school performs well. You are accountable to tests, whether those tests are accurate or inaccurate, and I clearly agree with Tom Carroll in terms of most of his points on issues with testing in New York and the way it's done, problems with the delivery of the test, problems with the teachers marking their own tests. There are lots of issues around those tests. So accurate or inaccurate, the teacher is responsible for it. So, you know, it's a myth that teachers do not welcome accountability. Accountability is just something that's there all the time. We live and breathe it, and we'll deal with it as it grows. And just on the value-added, I'm certainly not going to be the one to define the difference, but I tend to think that as we talk about growth models, and the more I hear about growth models, it makes more sense than simply value-added. But that's, you know, problem ratios, we just haven't seen one, as both speakers have clearly defined. We haven't seen one that makes me terribly comfortable to say, you know, we found the panacea to move with.
Thank you.
My longtime friend, Chancellor Emeritus Hayden, there's one detail about his background that EJ didn't mention. He's the only trial lawyer ever to have won the Business Council's Corning Award. which we gave to him not because of those lawsuits over workers' comp, but because of his extraordinary record in leading New York's transformation into a state that did have testing that was used to make public accountability of the school system at a time when everyone was saying testing could never possibly work. All it would ever do is take all the creativity out of the classroom. Everybody would turn to doing nothing but teaching to the test. And I know he rode out that storm of criticism, and I'd be interested in, Carl, in hearing your perspective on it after the fact.
Well, I think you ride out that storm of criticism because you have to. At the end of the day, the public demands and the public ought to demand a system of accountability that in which they can have confidence. And that means that it has to be one that's objectively verifiable. It has to be rigorous. And it has to be consistent across the entire state. We're really blessed in New York that we've had a history of Regents exams since Saul was a boy, and that means they have facial validity. The public does indeed have confidence in the Regents exam system. And what it means is New York did not have to fight the fight about high-stakes examinations that other states had to fight. From my vantage point, David, if you would ask me what we did in the years that, in the 12 years that I was a member of the Board of Regents, that was most important. And you know, we can obviously debate the implications of everything we did, but from my vantage point, what was most important were really two things. The first was to eliminate the local diploma, to eliminate the low standards route to graduation, to eliminate that part of the student cohort who had an educational experience that consisted of being exposed to a low standards curriculum and to be and who were then allowed to graduate by successfully completing a low standards examination. And when you talk about graduation rates, I think you need to be careful. I was struck by Dr. Peterson's comments with respect to graduation rates. Be careful what you wish for in the realm of graduation rates, because it's no problem getting everyone to graduate. You make it dumb enough, they all walk across the stage. The real question is, what stands behind the credential? And while I know that Saul and others are big proponents of the market, and that's a perfectly reasonable position, you have to be a little bit careful about the way in which the market incents educational process. And that's a convoluted way of observing that the market demand in 1990, the year I became a member of the Board of Regents, was generating 62% graduation rate in the state of New York for students holding a local diploma, a low standards diploma, and only 38% a Regents diploma. So where the market wanted to go was dumber and dumber, because their idea was, if I put my kid in a local program, my child will get a higher grade and therefore be a more attractive candidate for admission to college. That was the psychology. All right. So from my vantage point, eliminating the trap door that the system had at its disposal for shunting off to the side all of the kids who were not adept learners, and to the point that the great majority of the kids were on this low standards track, eliminating that was a tremendous blow for quality and for equity. Because guess who those kids were in the main? That's where the poor kids went. They were predominantly children of color. They were predominantly coming from urban and rural settings, many of them at risk. So that was number one. And David, number two, before I get into a full-blown filibuster here, was the report card. Demanding that the schools account for their results, however imperfect the methodology, demanding that the schools account for their results was a very significant stroke, because among other things, it stoked the public dialogue and for the first time empowered parents with the kind of information that had heretofore been the province of only the insiders. And I think the character and the quality of the debate about public education was transformed as a result of that.
Thank you. I've often wished I had been in Tom Rogers' office the day the governor announced that one of the proposals he was going to float was a firing clause in the clause of all the school superintendents, just in the hopes that I could have collected a nickel for every phone call that came in. But Tom, I want to ask you to talk about that in a positive way, that whether they respond directly to the proposal. What could the state do to help superintendents drive performance improvements?
Well, first of all, I'd also echo my panelists' comment that we appreciate this opportunity to talk, and I'm struck by the fact that as Tom Carroll's job looks more and more like a superintendency, his writing makes more and more sense to me. So we're also very supportive of almost everything that's in there, and your analysis of the problems with the tests echo a lot of things that we've been saying for about 10 years now. So with that as sort of a prefatory remark to respond more directly, we didn't get a lot of calls about that on the day that it was proposed, because most of the superintendents that I've talked to since have said, well, I can already be fired. And in fact, one superintendent said to me, I sign a contract for excellence every 3 years. And if the board doesn't want me anymore, they don't have to renew that contract, and we're ready to go and look somewhere else. And just one last thought on this. The proposal assumes, of course, that if you threaten someone, they'll do better, and that the only thing that was keeping them from doing better was the lack of a threat. And I think that's probably misguided. And it also presumes that jobs in low-performing schools are so attractive that if you fire one person, there's a line of 10 waiting to get in behind them. And I'm not just talking about superintendencies. I'm talking about principal jobs and teaching jobs as well. So I think we have to recognize that as we construct a system of aligned incentives and consequences, that we keep in mind a way of incentivizing working in places that are otherwise challenging. And so I would think that a way to move forward from here is to say the governor has opened up the door on accountability, and it's a pretty robust door. Someone called it bold, and that gives us a pretty bold playing field to talk about ideas. I don't think that a system will be structured that can really make the kinds of changes Dr. Peterson was talking about unless you have aligned incentives throughout the system. So about 10% of superintendents in the state have performance agreements in their contracts. If you raise student achievement X percent, you get X dollars at the end of the year. And I talked to them. I said, is this a good idea? Should we be encouraging this for more superintendents? And they say, well, here's what happens in practice. If I push too hard on the principals or on the teachers, eventually I get to a point where there's kickback and they say, look, we're not doing this just so you can make your bonus. And as a result, there's only so far they can go. So if we have a system where rewards are aligned throughout the system and consequences are aligned throughout the system, it's more likely that leaders will be able to lead. I think superintendents would be ready to trade sole accountability for sole authority, but no one's really put that on the table. So recognizing that that's not going to be put on the table, then you have to say, okay, what are things short of that that you can do that align those incentives? And I think that the way to structure that is to look first at having the right trigger, and the right trigger would not be triggered by the amount of an aid increase, but rather by whether or not there is low performance in that school. Those are the schools that we want to focus our attention on, not high-performing schools that happen to have gotten a lot of money. Because as Tom said, these contracts will be onerous. They will be tough to do. We should put that energy where it's needed most. The second is, once we identify the right schools to deal with, we should have a system that's of accountability that is both a reward system and a consequence system. And those rewards can be structured in a lot of ways, and I think there'll be a lot of ideas about how that works, but they have to be similar. I, as the superintendent, need to be held accountable for the same measured goal that everyone else is being held accountable for. So one person's goal can't be longevity, and another person's goal can't be making the board happy, and a third person's goal has to be raising the test scores. We all have to have the same goal so that we're working together in concert. And then if we identify a system of consequences, we need to stratify that so that the first consequences are remedial consequences. They're corrective consequences. Because we can't assume that the reason why things aren't going well is simply because folks don't want to do the job. We have to assume that maybe they don't have the skills to do the job. Maybe it's a place that's so undesirable to work that there are very few certified teachers available. We have to find a way to give them the knowledge and skills to succeed. That's the first effort, and we should give that intervention time to succeed. Then make the decision that we've put the supports in place, we have the right people in place, the structures still aren't improving, then we can talk about consequences that are punitive in nature as opposed to corrective in nature. So I think there's a way to take the governor's initial idea flesh it out an awful lot more and be sensible about ways that it ramps up over time, but that we look at this as a way of encouraging good performance as a way instead of punishing bad performance until the end.
Thank you.
Saul Stern, question for you. Do you think, and I'm drawing here on some things you've written about, do you think we can trust the system ultimately to be honest in assessing its results and be forthcoming in trying to respond to them? A one-word answer will not do.
You're not going to get a one-word answer. First of all, again, also thanks for inviting me. I see I'm the only Southerner on this panel. I come from this little town about 130 miles south of here, which is going to eat up practically all of the money that the governor has already laid on the table. And I also, I'm a New Yorker, so I'm going to be contentious. I don't think we should all be singing Kumbaya about the future of education in this state. What I notice is basically since No Child Left Behind and probably before that, any politician who ever comes forward with a new education program, of course, uses the word accountability as a mantra. And I don't mean to be flippant about this. And in fact, Paul's presentation was absolutely brilliant when you get down to the actual details. But the two facts, that accountability itself never taught a child to read. And second, if you're a taxpayer, when you hear the word accountability now, the first thing you ought to do is start reaching for your wallet. And I wanted to get a perspective on what we're talking about in the governor's program. I want to give you some inconvenient truths, and I know I won't get an Academy Award for it, about what had happened in New York City over the last 5 years. I mean, it is the biggest school district in the country, and as I said, is going to eat up most of this extra funding. And I love the governor's speech, and I agree with Tom's analysis of it. Those are wonderful words, and I hope everything comes true. But I remember an almost identical speech when we had mayoral control in New York City. In fact, it was almost 4 years, exactly 4 years ago, on Martin Luther King Day in 2003, the mayor came forward and said, we're going to completely turn up, change the culture. Use every phrase that we heard today. Change this dysfunctional culture. No more excuses for failure. We're going to hold everyone accountable. We're not just going to throw bad money after good money. You're going to get a bigger bang for the buck. And the biggest reason of that is, for the first time ever, you're going to have someone to hold accountable for failure. Me. Okay, what in fact happened after that? The first thing that the chancellor of the New York City school system did was put into place a reading program top down in every school in the city that has absolutely no track record. That has never been studied, doesn't have one single, what Paul would call a gold standard test to support it, balanced literacy. And he has disdained reading programs that are supported by 30 years of scientific research conducted by the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. What's the result? Well, the first result is, as I said, reach for your wallet, and I don't have PowerPoint. I didn't go to Paul's program at Harvard and learn it, so you'll have to take my word for it. Here's a little chart, And what we see in this from the New York City Department of Education. We went in total spending since the mayor announced his reforms. State and city funds alone went up by close to $4 billion. The total budget went from $12 billion, you see all the bar graphs going way, way, way up. In 3 years, New York City funding for education went from a little over almost $14 billion up to $18 billion. That's a $4 billion increase in 3 years. What did we get for it? Again, sorry, you'll have to take my word for it. Grade 4 English. It's a really ironic picture. The mayor, of course, the mayor and the chancellor claim huge historic gains. Actually, if you look, and I have a chart, this is from the State Education Department, comparing New York City reading scores from 1999 to 2006. The scores, the average increase for the first 4 years on that, when we didn't have, quote, accountability, when we were under a dysfunctional Board of Ed with all these chancellors that didn't know what, you know, we're not going to reform the system, scores went up by an average of about 4% a year. Under accountability and mayoral control, they went up by about half that much. They went up a little, but about half that much. Is that worth $4 billion? Even more appalling, grade 8 English. You look at 99 to 2006. Grade 8 English scores for those 7 years, including the 4 years under mayoral control, went up by 1.5%. 99, 35.3% of eighth graders could read at grade level. 2006, 36.6%. If 36.6% of your eighth graders read at grade level, what are we even arguing about graduation rates? Kids can't read at grade level, they're not gonna succeed in high school. So whatever happened to accountability? Well, you know what the mayor says? This is what we got for mayoral control. And I was a supporter of mayoral control. I wrote, after that wonderful speech, I was impressed, just like I'm impressed with the governor's speech. I did an article for City Journal titled Two Cheers for Mayor Bloomberg. Before, and now I'm one of his biggest critics. But what does he say about mayoral control? How do we hold the mayor accountable? The people who run the system accountable? Well, the mayor said, basically, accountability is one election, one time, because we have term limits. And he said, if you don't like what I'm doing on education, you can vote me out. But what if I don't like what he's doing on education, but I like Freddie Ferrer even less? What do I do then? Well, actually, the mayor actually answered the question. What he said was, and I quote him literally, he said, well, you can boo me at parades. So where is the accountability? And that's why you're now beginning finally to see a protest movement in New York City. It started, unfortunately, it didn't start over the fact, which it should, people should be in the streets over the fact that eighth grade reading is still at 36.6%. It started like these things always do, because one of the brilliant consultants that the mayor hired to save money wound up leaving, you know, redesigned the bus routes and wound up leaving thousands of kids standing on street corners in the middle of the winter waiting for the buses that didn't come. So let me come back to Governor Spitzer. What's the lesson of this? Again, to me, the lesson is don't put the money on the table before you have the accountability in place. I don't understand for the life of me why he agreed to go for the $5.4 for New York City education. And I don't have time now to discuss it, but in my view, if you look at the actual decision by the Court of Appeals, the actual language, he didn't have to do a penny. And I'm not saying he shouldn't have done a penny or whatever, but there was no legal obligation anymore at the end of this case for the governor to propose extra money. The reason he did it was not, and if it doesn't work in 4 years, he can't say the courts made me do it. He did it for political and policy reasons, which is as it should be. That's the way education decisions should be made. But why he put the money on the table before there was any accountability in place, I don't understand. And the second point I don't understand is accountability for the extra money he's sending, the state will now send to New York. But we already have an $18 billion budget. It's not chopped liver. Where's the accountability for that $18 billion? I don't see it. And given the precedent in New York, I really have to wonder where we're going to be in 4 years. Thank you.
I thank you. You've got all the other panelists raising their hands under the table. I have a bunch of questions myself, but I'd first like to ask each panelist for a chance to follow up or redirect. Then I want to open it to the audience, and then if we have more time, we'll hear more from me. Maybe back in the same order that we started in. Tim Kramer, anything you heard that you're dying to answer, or anything about the governor's approach that you didn't get to cover before that you'd like?
The only things I would add very briefly, I did say that our organization, New York State School Board Association, is supportive of the Spitzer proposals for accountability, but we do have some caveats. We do believe that whatever the consequences are, whatever the incentives are, they have to be leading toward higher student achievement. The standards that need to be in place for adequate progress need to be fair. I think you've heard from a lot of the panel members their concerns about the measurements. We also we believe that Dick is right in talking about levels of accountability that his members feel inherently in their jobs, but we think teachers must be held accountable along with boards and superintendents and principals. They were kind of left out of that system in the remarks made by the governor. And we believe that the measurements that need to be in place not only need to be credible, but they need to be diagnostic. Tom, you talked about the fact you got these test scores so late in the game. So there's very little you can do because these kids are gone. We need to get those test scores in such a way that we can use that information to help these children attend to their weaknesses or their strengths. So we need to get them not only in a diagnostic fashion, but a timely fashion. That's all I would add.
All right, thanks. Dick?
Well, I've never met Saul before, but I've been told that nobody corrects Saul, so I'm going to get a chance to correct Saul. Actually, Saul, I'm from Long Island, so I am further south than here, so I get to say that and move it on. I hear what you're saying about the accountability and the dollars, whether the dollars, you know, but the question here is what has to be improved, and the governor's call for reforms, and I think if we're looking for reforms, that's where the dollars were necessary, and more importantly, the CFE issue is just a matter of equity in New York State. The fact is that urban centers, poverty centers, school districts that deal predominantly with children of color have been treated unfairly in the state of New York when it comes to dollars, and that had to be addressed, and that is a major part of what the governor has done, and we commend him on that. I want to stress Carl's point because I think that is really a very important one. The movement in New York State towards higher standards has been in the mix about NCLB and in the rush to discuss all sorts of variations of accountability. We have really not patted ourselves on the back enough on the issue of standards because we have done a lot with standards and. Some of us were not as excited about the Board of Regents moving in that direction, but great credit to them for taking that step early, and I think that that's a plus that New York needs to take credit for going in that direction, and now we have to see how we do the accountability piece to follow it up.
Well, I have you here. Do I get you to ask how you feel about the governor's proposal on tenure?
I'm fine with the governor's proposal on tenure. If people need time to write that down, I'll say that. I'm fine with the governor's proposal on tenure. The governor's proposal on tenure speaks to the granting of tenure. He speaks to the granting of tenure with three pieces. The first of it has to do with the role of administration in evaluating teachers. That already exists. I think what's maybe missing is whether we are as careful and as deliberate about that process as we should be. I think that teachers would welcome it being done properly. The second part that the governor talks about is a role for peers. I read into the peers piece mentoring. New York State is one of the, I think, only 7 or 8 or 9 states in the country that actually mandate mentoring. I think the more mentoring we do, the better prepared teachers will be, and the better sense we will have of whether a teacher should be granted tenure. And then the governor talks about available data. And within the context of what both Professor Peterson and Tom have said about the quality of the data and the accuracy of tests, I think there is data out there. And if we take that data and we look at it in the context of the views of mentoring and the role of evaluation, I think we could make a real good picture of who should be granted tenure and who should not be granted tenure. There is no value to the teachers' union in what we profess to do to advance the needs of our members in having teachers who can't perform. So why wouldn't we be supportive of it?
Thank you. Carl, any follow-up?
Yeah. David, I can't resist the temptation to rise to Saul's CFE bait. I'm a CFE board member, Saul. I know. And I think most of the people in this room are going to know that the number that the Court of Appeals adopted was a footnote from a Standard & Poor's report that was included in the Zarb Commission recommendations. That footnote had nothing to recommend it except that it happened to be the lowest number they could find in the entire report. There was no logic to commend it. There was certainly no link between that number and what was actually needed. What you didn't mention from your charts, and I thought I'm the last person in the world to be defending the mayor, but for all of its troubles, New York City is doing a better job than the other cities in the Big Five in terms of student performance, woeful as it is. No, I don't think it always did.
Yes.
But in any event, look, the whole business of moving a large sum of money to New York City schools is an attempt to cure a historic inequity. And as far as I'm concerned, it's a moral imperative. So I see the logic.
Tom?
I love the lightning round. Bunch of sound bites. First of all, I want to echo what Dick said about children in poverty, because that's the thing that gets overlooked in all of this. As I was watching Professor Peterson's presentation, and he showed a lot of historical data over time going back into the 70s, if you look at the 15-year period leading up to the Nation at Risk report, where they worried about a rising tide of mediocrity, what we really had was a rising tide of poverty. And the chart for how steeply the percentage of kids in poverty went up during that period is astonishing. That's also the same period in time when we decided that we were going to finally educate disabled children along with the regular school population. We were going to educate children of color along with the regular school population, even though that was something that was enacted in 1954 with the Brown decision. It didn't really start getting a lot of momentum until the late 60s and Title I was put into place. So those are the kinds of things that create the context. And New York is 23rd out of the 24 industrialized democracies, the OECD nations, in rate of kids in poverty. In fact, we're one of only two nations with more than 20% kids in poverty. And all of the international comparisons at which we do middle of the pack, all of the countries that beat us have levels of poverty that are between 5 and 10%. The entire European Union's under 10%. So that's who we're competing against, and actually fairly favorably considering the mix of kids that they have. I like to talk about inputs and kid puts, and our kid puts are terrible. We have tons of kids in poverty, and the fact that we do a middling job with them actually speaks to how robust a system we have. Second thought, if we're going to have tests, and we are, and we know that people will teach to tests, then we might as well have tests worth teaching to. The tests we have now are a dramatic improvement over the tests that they replaced. And the next generation of assessments will be even better than these. But we can't rely on the assessments we have now. We've got to start thinking about tests that test higher order thinking skills, the ability to problem solve, the ability to be innovative, to work in groups, and to assemble the work of others, because globalization is going to drive work into various corners of the world wherever that work is cheapest, and the value added is going to be in some place where we have workers who can reassemble that work and think about it. Third point is, I also agree with Richard's point that we have to do better evaluation. My members have to do better evaluation. We don't do nearly as good a job of evaluating and supporting teachers as we should. It's something that we try to drive. One of the things that gets in the way is the concern that it's not a productive use of time because there's not a lot you can do with that evaluation. But I don't think that's a valid excuse, and I think it's something that we have to do more with. And then final comment on value-added testing, which I think is a promising innovation and something that we should work at, particularly as we get better tests, value-added testing will make more sense. And I agree with Tim, most of the research I've read on it says it's interesting, but it's not ready for prime time. You certainly wouldn't want to build a compensation system on top of value-added testing yet. And if we think about our current state testing system, I made a quick list of all the kinds of tests there are out there. We have formative tests, summative tests, instructionally supportive tests, diagnostic tests, performance tests, and accountability assessments. All of those tests are constructed in different ways. The state has one test, and we're trying to use it to do all of those things. It's like trying to play golf with only one club. Driver or a putter, pick it and play the whole round. So we need to recognize that whatever the state does with its tests, it has to be supported by assessments in school districts that are formative, that are given throughout the year, and that are recursive. They go back and inform instruction. If we don't do any of that, then using these state tests where the data is 6 to 8 months old by the time you get it to try and run a value-added system, a diagnostic system, and an instructive system, it's going to collapse. It just won't work. So we have to do an awful lot more to improve our assessments.
Saul?
Let me answer a few points that were addressed to me. The first one was Chancellor Hayden's comment that it was unfair to the poor mayor, that in fact the city is doing much better than other urban centers in New York City, in New York State. I responded, it always did better, and he said, no. I happen to have my chart, and 1999, New York City, 35% of eighth graders achieved grade level in reading, Buffalo, 31%, Rochester, 23%, Syracuse, 30%, Yonkers, 29%. As I said, New York City always did better. So
the world didn't start in 1999.
Oh, so you have some numbers before 99? Yeah? Okay. Well, bring it next time. Historic inequity. I was unfair to CFE. I wasn't only unfair to the mayor. I was unfair to poor CFE. I actually support equity in education. If, in fact, I like the Abbott case, I like the Abbott decisions in New Jersey because it was based on the idea of inequity. Every child in the state ought to have basically the same amount of money attached to them. I don't see why my kids, when they went to school in New York City, shouldn't have had the same amount of money than kids in Scarsdale just because they have a higher tax base. So I support the concept. Unfortunately, in New Jersey as well, what we now know after 15 years of the Abbott decision is that the kids who are now getting exactly the same amount of money in those horrendous districts in New Jersey are doing not much better than they did 15 years ago. That's the reality. But the problem with the CFE case for 13 years, 14 years, well, I find two things wrong with the CFE case. We spent 14 years in the courts. It cost about $50 million in litigation costs. $50 million when you count defense and the plaintiffs and the court costs. And at the end of this 14-year process, we wound up already enough money in the New York City system as the decision would have allocated. In other words, the political process was working all that time to bring more money to New York City. The other thing that was wrong with that case is that it was based around a question that can't be answered and is indeed unanswerable. And that's the idea that if you reach some magic amount of money put into the system, that's going to give you an adequate education. Everything we know, all the data we have from the city in all these years, indicates that that's not true. I'm not saying that there aren't things that should be funded that are important. Of course, for example, if you ask me what would I fund, I would say, I would put a lot of money in K-3 reading. I would reduce class size in K-3 to 18, and I'd put in reading programs that actually work, that have been tested. There's really strong evidence that something like that would lift reading scores, particularly for low-performing minority kids. But that's not what's being done as a result of this process. And the other problem with the CFE, and it's created an enormous, a terrible pall on education debate, and it's, we didn't talk about education. We talked about money for 15 years. Hopefully, at least when the governor's, you know, $5.4 billion comes to New York City, and we're spending $20,000 per pupil, $20,000 per pupil in 4 years, we will finally start figuring out that it's not money. We better start talking about education and talking about what works, particularly what instructional methods, what reading and math programs actually work, which ones have evidence behind them.
All right, thank you. I can't resist one observation, which is that for years I've been wondering what is the amount of money after which we could stop talking about money.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently Elliot Spitzer has found it. You know?
Oh, really?
This panel
suggests
we're there. I mean, I hope it lasts. But in town, really the only people you hear complaining about the amount of money in the budget is, as far as I can tell, individual legislators who have particular local issues. You know, he seems to have hit the aggregate number, Saul, so maybe we're past that. Now, I'm going to shut up at this time and ask anybody in the audience has any follow-up.